Chapter 4. Let me Google that for you. How unlimited information is making us dumber. My mind now expects to take in information the way the net distributes it, in a swiftly moving stream of particles. Once I was a scuba diver in the sea of words, now I zip along the surface like a guy on a jet ski. Nicholas Carr. Although the internet could be making all of us smarter, it makes many of us stupider. Because it's not just a magnet for the curious, it's a sinkhole for the gullible. It renders everyone an instant expert. You have a degree? Well, I did a Google search. Frank Bruni. Do not believe everything you read on the internet, especially quotes from famous people. Abraham Lincoln. Probably. The Return of Sturgeon's Law. Ask any professional or expert about the death of expertise, and most of them will immediately blame the same culprit, the internet. People who once had to ask the advice of specialists in any given field now plug search terms into a browser and get answers in seconds. Why rely on people with more education and experience than you, or worse, have to make appointments with them, when you can just get the information yourself? Chest pain? Ask your computer. Why does my chest hurt? Will generate more than 11 million results, at least on the search engine I just used, in exactly 0.52 seconds. A stream of information will fill your screen with helpful advice from sources ranging from the National Institutes of Health to other outfits whose bona fides are a tad less reputable. Some of these sites will even walk the would-be patient through a diagnosis. Your doctor might have a different opinion, but who is he to argue with a glowing screen that will answer your question in less than a single second? In fact, who is anyone to argue with anyone? In the information age, there's no such thing as an irresolvable argument. Each of us is now walking around with more accumulated information on a smartphone or tablet than ever existed in the entire Library of Alexandria. At the beginning of this book, I mentioned the character Cliff Clavin, from the classic television show Cheers, the local know-it-all who routinely lectured the other regulars in a Boston pub on every subject under the sun. But Cliff couldn't exist today. At the first claim of, "It's a known fact," everyone in the bar could pull out a phone and verify, or more likely, disprove, any of Cliff's claims. Put another way, technology has created a world in which we're all Cliff Clavin now. And that's a problem. Despite what irritated professionals may think, however, the internet is not the primary cause of challenges to their expertise. Rather, the internet has accelerated the collapse of communication between experts and laypeople by offering an apparent shortcut to erudition. It allows people to mimic intellectual accomplishment by indulging in an illusion of expertise provided by a limitless supply of facts. Facts, as experts know, are not the same as knowledge or ability. And on the internet, facts are sometimes not even facts. In the various skirmishes and the campaigns against established knowledge, the internet is like artillery support, a constant bombardment of random, disconnected information that rains down on experts and ordinary citizens alike, deafening all of us while blowing up attempts at reasonable discussion. Internet users have created many humorous laws and corollaries to describe discussion in the electronic world. The tendency to bring up Nazi Germany in any argument inspired Godwin's Law and the related Reductio ad Hitlerum. The deeply entrenched and usually immutable views of internet users are the foundation of Palmer's Law, in which the internet can only change a person's mind from having no opinion to having a wrong opinion. There are many others, including my personal favorite, Skitt's Law, which is, any internet message correcting an error in another post will contain at least one error in itself. When it comes to the death of expertise, however, the law to bear in mind is an observation coined long before the advent of the personal computer. Sturgeon's Law, named for the legendary science fiction writer Theodore Sturgeon. In the early 1950s, highbrow critics derided the quality of popular literature, particularly American science fiction. They considered sci-fi and fantasy writing a literary ghetto, and almost all of it, they sniffed, was worthless. Sturgeon angrily responded by noting that the critics were setting too high a bar. Most products in most fields, he argued, are of low quality, including what was then considered serious writing. 90% of everything, Sturgeon decreed, is crap. Where the internet is concerned, Sturgeon's law of 90% might be lowballing. The sheer size and volume of the internet, and the inability to separate meaningful knowledge from random noise, mean that good information will always be swamped by lousy data and weird detours. Worse, there's no way to keep up with it all, even if any group or institution wanted to try. In 1994, there were fewer than 3,000 websites online. By 2014, there were more than 1 billion sites. Most of them are searchable and will arrive before your eyes in mere seconds, regardless of their quality. The good news is that even if Sturgeon's Law holds, that's still 100 million pretty good websites. These include all the major news publications of the world, many of which are now read more in pixels than on paper, as well as the homepages of think tanks, universities, research organizations, and any number of important scientific, cultural, and political figures. The bad news, of course, is that finding all of this information means plowing through a blizzard of useless or misleading information posted by everyone from well-intentioned grandmothers to the killers of the Islamic State. Some of the smartest people on Earth have a significant presence on the internet. Some of the stupidest people on the same planet, however, reside just one click away on the next page or hyperlink. The countless dumpsters of nonsense parked on the internet are a Sturgeon's Law nightmare. People who already have to make hard choices about getting information from a few dozen news channels on their televisions now face millions upon millions of web pages produced by anyone willing to pay for an online presence. The internet is without a doubt a great achievement that continues to change our lives for the better by allowing more people more access to information and to each other than ever before in history. But it also has a dark side that is exerting important and deeply negative effects on the ways people gain knowledge and respond to expertise. The most obvious problem is that the freedom to post anything online floods the public square with bad information and half-baked thinking. The internet lets a billion flowers bloom, and most of them stink, including everything from the idle thoughts of random bloggers and the conspiracy theories of cranks, all the way to the sophisticated campaigns of disinformation conducted by groups and governments. Some of the information on the internet is wrong because of sloppiness. Some of it is wrong because well-meaning people just don't know any better. And some of it is wrong because it was put there out of greed or even sheer malice. The medium itself, without comment or editorial intervention, displays it all with equal speed. The internet is a vessel, not a referee. This, of course, is no more and no less than an updated version of the basic paradox of the printing press. As the writer Nicholas Carr pointed out, the arrival of Gutenberg's invention in the 15th century set off a round of teeth-gnashing among early humanists, who worried that printed books and broadsheets would undermine religious authority, demean the work of scholars and scribes, and spread sedition and debauchery. Those medieval naysayers weren't entirely wrong. The printing press was used to mass-produce Bibles, to teach people to read, and eventually to empower the literacy that drives so much of human freedom. Of course, it also enabled the dissemination of insanity, like the protocols of the Elders of Zion, taught people to confuse words with facts, and supported the creation of totalitarian propaganda that undermined the same human freedom. The internet is the printing press at the speed of fiber optics. In addition to enabling torrents of misinformation, the internet is weakening the ability of laypeople and scholars alike to do basic research, a skill that would help everyone to navigate this wilderness of bad data. This might seem an odd claim coming from a member of the scholarly community, because I gladly admit that internet access makes my work as a writer a lot easier. In the 1980s, I had to put together a dissertation by lugging around armloads of books and articles. Today, I keep browser bookmarks and folders full of electronically readable articles at my fingertips. How can that not be better than the hours I spent going blind in front of a copier in the bowels of a library? In some ways, the convenience of the internet is a tremendous boon, but mostly for people already trained in research and who have some idea what they're looking for. It's much easier to subscribe to the electronic version of, say, Foreign Affairs or International Security than it is to decamp to the library or impatiently check an office mailbox. This is no help, unfortunately, for a student or an untrained layperson who has never been taught how to judge the provenance of information or the reputability of a writer. Libraries, or at least their reference and academic sections, once served as a kind of first cut through the noise of the marketplace. Visiting a library was an education in itself, especially for a reader who took the time to ask for help from a librarian. The internet, however, is nothing like a library. Rather, it's a giant repository where anyone can dump anything, from a first folio to a faked photograph, from a scientific treatise to pornography, from short bulletins of information to meaningless electronic graffiti. It's an environment almost entirely without regulation, which opens the door to content being driven by marketing, politics, and the uninformed decisions of other laypeople, rather than the judgment of experts. Can 50 million Elvis fans really be wrong? Of course they can. In practice, this means that a search for information will cough up whatever algorithm is at work in a search engine, usually provided by for-profit companies using criteria that are largely opaque to the user. A youngster who takes to the internet to satisfy a curiosity about tanks in World War II will more likely come up with a TV personality Bill O'Reilly's ridiculous but best-selling Killing Patton than with the chewier but more accurate work of the best military historians of the 20th century. On the internet, as in life, money and popularity, unfortunately, count for a lot. Plugging words into a browser window isn't research. It's asking questions of programmable machines that themselves cannot actually understand human beings. Actual research is hard, and for people raised in an environment of constant electronic stimulation, it's also boring. Research requires the ability to find authentic information, summarize it, analyze it, write it up, and present it to other people. It is not just the province of scientists and scholars, but a basic set of skills a high school education should teach every graduate because of its importance in any number of jobs and careers. But why bother with all that tedious hoop jumping when the screen in front of us already has the answers, generated by the millions in just seconds and beautifully laid out in colorful, authoritative-looking websites? The deeper issue here is that the internet is actually changing the way we read, the way we reason, even the way we think, and all for the worse. We expect information instantly. We want it broken down, presented in a way that is pleasing to our eye. No more of those small-type, fragile textbooks, thank you. And we want it to say what we want it to say. People do not do research so much as they search for pretty pages online to provide answers they like with the least amount of effort and in the shortest time. The resulting flood of information, always of varying quality and sometimes of uncertain sanity, creates a veneer of knowledge that actually leaves people worse off than if they knew nothing at all. It's an old saying, but it's true. It ain't what you don't know that'll hurt you. It's what you do know that ain't so. Finally, and perhaps most disturbingly, the internet is making us meaner, shorter-fused, and incapable of conducting discussions where anyone learns anything. The major problem with instantaneous communication is that it is instantaneous. While the internet enables more people to talk to each other than ever before, a distinctly new historical condition, Everyone talking immediately to everyone else might not always be such a good idea. Sometimes, human beings need to pause and to reflect, to give themselves time to absorb information and to digest it. Instead, the internet is an arena in which people can react without thinking, and thus in turn, they become invested in defending their gut reactions rather than accepting new information or admitting a mistake, especially if it's a mistake pointed out by people with greater learning or experience. What's fake on the internet? Everything. There isn't enough time to catalog the amount of bad information on the internet. Miracle cures, conspiracy theories, faked documents, misattributed quotes, all of these and more are the crabgrass and weeds that have rapidly overgrown a global garden of knowledge. The healthier but less sturdy grasses and flowers don't stand a chance. Durable old urban legends and conspiracy theories, for example, have been reconditioned and given new life online. We've all heard stories of alligators in the sewers, improbable celebrity deaths, and libraries that fell down because no one counted on the weight of the books in them, told and retold mostly by word of mouth. On the internet, these stories are presented with beautiful layouts and graphics. They now spread so fast through email and social media that there are groups, like the Admirable Project at Snopes.com and other fact-checking organizations, who do nothing but stomp out these intellectual wastebasket fires all day long. Unfortunately, they're shoveling against the tide. People do not come to the internet so that their bad information can be corrected or their cherished theories disproven. Rather, they ask the electronic oracle to confirm them in their ignorance. In 2015, a Washington Post writer, Caitlin Dewey, worried that fact-checking could never defeat myths and hoaxes because no one has the time or cognitive capacity to reason all the apparent nuances and discrepancies out. In the end, she sighed, debunking them doesn't do a darn thing. 2 months after she wrote those words, Dewey and the Post threw in the towel and ceased her weekly "What is Fake on the Internet" column. There was no way to keep up with the madness, especially once hoaxers figured out how to make money out of spreading myths for precious clicks on websites. Frankly, Dewey told her readers, this column wasn't designed to address the current environment. This format doesn't make sense. More alarming were the conversations Dewey had with professional researchers who told her that institutional distrust is so high right now, and cognitive bias so strong always, that the people who fall for hoax news stories are frequently only interested in consuming information that conforms with their views, even when it's demonstrably fake. Dewey and the Post fought the internet, and the internet won. A lot of nonsense, particularly in politics, thrives on the reach and staying power of the internet. A stubborn group of cranks might still believe the earth is flat or that Americans never walked on the moon, but eventually all the pictures from space are good enough for the rest of us. When it comes to urban legends like Barack Obama's African birth, George W. Bush's orchestration of the 9/11 terror attacks, or the U.S. Treasury's secret plan to replace the dollar with a global currency, astronauts with cameras cannot help. Social media, websites, and chat rooms turn myths, stories heard from a friend of a friend, and rumors into facts. As the British writer Damian Thompson has explained, instant communication is empowering people and groups dedicated to crackpot ideas, some of them quite dangerous. Thompson calls this counter-knowledge, in that it all flies in the face of science and is completely impervious to contrary evidence. He writes, now, thanks to the internet, a rumor about the Antichrist can leap from Goths in Sweden to an extreme traditionalist Catholic sect in Australia in a matter of seconds. Minority groups are becoming ever more tolerant of each other's eccentric doctrines. Contacts between black and white racists, which began tentatively decades ago, are now flourishing as the two groups swap conspiracy theories. In a slower, less connected world, these kinds of groups could not reinforce their beliefs with instantaneous affirmation from other extremists online. The free movement of ideas is a powerful driver of democracy, but it always carries the risk that ignorant or evil people will bend the tools of mass communication to their own needs and propagate lies and myths that no expert can dispel. Worse, bad information can stay online for years. Unlike yesterday's newspaper, online information is persistent and will pop up in subsequent searches after appearing just once. Even when falsehoods or mistakes are deleted at the source, they'll show up in an archive somewhere else. If the stories in them go viral and travel the electronic world in days, hours, or even minutes, they're effectively impossible to correct. For example, in 2005, the conservative gadfly, Alan West, broke a make-believe scoop that President Obama was forcing members of the U.S. military to pray like Muslims for Ramadan. West's website juxtaposed a blaring headline, "Look what our troops are being forced to do," against a picture of U.S. soldiers kneeling with their heads to prayer mats. It was a startling visual, and the story spread rapidly through social media. No such thing had occurred. West had recycled a picture, taken several years earlier, of actual Muslims in the U.S. military at prayer. Even after objections were raised to the misleading picture, by me, among others, West did not pull the story. It wouldn't have mattered since it was already archived on blogs and other sites. People surfing the internet who have neither the training nor the time to ascertain the provenance of the information will from now on come across not only the original story but also thousands of repetitions of it and never know that the whole thing was bunk. Today, no one need be frustrated by fussy fact-checkers or resolute editors. Just as a nicely bound book could once mislead people into thinking its contents were authoritative, so too do slick websites provide the visual cues of reliability and authenticity that help uninformed readers spread bad information faster than any headline that William Randolph Hearst could have imagined. Experts and other professionals who insist on the dreary rigor of logic and factual accuracy cannot compete with a machine that will always give readers their preferred answer in 16 million colors. Of course it's safe. I Googled it. Leaving aside slick, self-produced websites and the inevitable Facebook posts and memes that crowd the internet, the search for quick answers has also facilitated the growth of entire industries based on selling bad ideas to the public and charging them for the privilege of being misinformed. I refer here not to online journalism, that's in the next chapter, but rather to the many outlets, often fronted by celebrities, that offer advice meant to supplant and replace established knowledge from experts. Are you a woman concerned about your reproductive health? I have no experience in these matters, but I'm told by the woman in my life that regular visits to the gynecologists are not something they particularly enjoy. Now that the internet has arrived, however, women have an alternative source of information other than medical professionals. The actress Gwyneth Paltrow has her own lifestyle magazine, GOOP.com, and she can discuss with you in the privacy of your home or via your smartphone the many things women can do to maintain their gynecological health, including steaming their vaginas. If you're unfamiliar with this practice, Ms. Paltrow highly recommends it. "You sit on what is essentially a mini throne," she said in 2014, "and a combination of infrared and mugwort steam cleanses your uterus and others. It is an energetic release, not just a steam douche, that balances female hormone levels. If you're in Los Angeles, you have to do it." Actual gynecologists, however, do not recommend that women in Los Angeles or anywhere else steam any of their middle anatomy. A gynecologist named Jen Gunter took to her own distinctly less glamorous website with a clear alternative recommendation, writing, "Steam isn't going to get into your uterus from your vagina unless you are using an attachment with some kind of pressure, and most definitely never ever do that. Mugwort or wormwood or whatever, when steamed, either vaginally or on the vulva, can't possibly balance any reproductive hormones, regulate your menstrual cycle, treat depression, or cure infertility. Even steamed estrogen couldn't do that. If you want to feel relaxed, get a good massage. If you want to relax your vagina, have an orgasm. Paltrow's site, however, is the epitome of hip, at least for a particular demographic. A satirist named Laura Hooper Beck captured the credulousness of Paltrow's fans perfectly, saying, "Basically, if a doctor tells me to do it, I'm going to take a hard pass. But if a skinny blonde in an ugly wig tells me that blowing hot air up my vagina is going to cure everything I've ever suffered from, including a bad relationship with my mother, well, then, I'm going to listen to Gwyneth Paltrow, because girlfriend knows science." It's easy. Too easy, I know, to make fun of vacuous celebrities. And since this is now more about steam and vaginas than I've ever written in my entire career, let's leave Paltrow and her health advice aside. There is nevertheless an important point here about the influence of the internet on the death of expertise. Because in an earlier time, a sensible American woman would have had to exert a great deal of initiative to find out how a Hollywood actress parboils her plumbing. Now, a woman searching for answers on everything from fashion to uterine cancer can accidentally spend more time reading Goop than talking to her doctor. Celebrities abusing their status as celebrities is nothing new, but the internet amplifies their effect. While we might dismiss Jim Carrey's anti-vaccine rants as an extension of the comedian's already unconventional personality, people with more storied names get sucked into the electronic funhouse as well. In 2015, the New York Times columnist Frank Bruni got a call from Robert F. Kennedy Jr., son of the senator and presidential candidate assassinated in 1968. It was important, Kennedy told Bruni, that they meet. Kennedy was insistent about correcting Bruni on the issue of vaccination. Like too many other Americans, Kennedy was lugging around ill-informed paranoia about vaccines causing, in Kennedy's words, a holocaust among American children. Indeed, Bruni noted that Kerry has obviously done worship in the church of Robert Kennedy Jr. Bruni later recalled of the meeting, "I had sided with the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the National Institutes of Health, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But Kennedy knew better." Kennedy, Kerry, and others did what many Americans do in such situations. They decided beforehand what they believed, and then went looking for a source on the internet to buttress that belief. As Bruni pointed out, the anti-vaccine agitators can always find a renegade researcher or random study to back them up. This is erudition in the age of cyberspace. You surf until you reach the conclusion you're after. You click your way to validation, confusing the presence of a website with the plausibility of an argument. This kind of internet grazing, mistakenly called research by laypeople, makes interactions between experts and professionals arduous. Once again, confirmation bias is a major culprit. Although many stories on the internet are false or inaccurate, the one-in-a-billion story where Google gets it right and the experts get it wrong goes viral. In a tragic case in 2015, for example, a British teenager was misdiagnosed by doctors who told her to stop Googling her symptoms. The patient insisted she had a rare cancer, a possibility the doctors dismissed. She was right, they were wrong, and she died. The British teen's story made big news, and a rare mistake likely convinced a great many people to be their own doctors. Of course, people who have died because they used a computer to misdiagnose their heart disease as indigestion never make the front page. But none of that matters. These David and Goliath stories, a teenager against her team of doctors, feed the public's insatiable confirmation bias and fuel their cynicism in established knowledge, while bolstering their false hopes that the solutions to their problems are just a few mouse clicks away. Once upon a time, books were at least a marginal barrier to the rapid dissemination of misinformation. But books took time to produce and required some investment and judgment on the part of a publisher. "I read it in a book" meant this probably isn't crazy because a company spent the money to put it between two covers and publish it. This was never entirely true about books, of course. Some of them are carefully fact-checked, peer-reviewed, and edited, while others are just slammed between covers and rushed to bookstores. Nonetheless, books from reputable presses go through at least a basic process of negotiation between authors, editors, reviewers, and publishers, including the book you're listening to right now. Books from self-published vanity presses, by contrast, are looked down upon by reviewers and readers alike, and with good reason. Today, however, the internet is the equivalent of hundreds of millions of vanity presses, all cranking out whatever anyone with a keyboard wants to say, no matter how stupid or how vile. As National Journal's Ron Fournier has said, in the age of the internet, every bigot is a publisher. There's a fair amount of wisdom and information hiding out there, but there's no escaping Sturgeon's Law. Accessing the internet can actually make people dumber than if they had never engaged a subject at all. The very act of searching for information makes people think they've learned something, when in fact they're more likely to be immersed in yet more data they do not understand. This happens because, after enough time surfing, people no longer can distinguish between things that may have flashed before their eyes and things they actually know. Seeing words on a screen is not the same as reading or understanding them. When a group of experimental psychologists at Yale investigated how people use the internet, they found that people who search for information on the web emerge from the process with an inflated sense of how much they know, even regarding topics that are unrelated to the ones they Googled. This is a kind of electronic version of the Dunning-Kruger effect, in which the least competent people surfing the web are the least likely to realize that they're not learning anything. People looking for information, say, about fossil fuels, might end up scrolling past many pages on a related term like dinosaur fossils. After enough websites fly by, they eventually lose the ability to recognize that whatever they just read about either subject isn't something they actually knew before they looked at a screen. Instead, they just assume that they knew things about both dinosaurs and diesel fuel because they're just that smart. Unfortunately, people thinking they're smart because they searched the internet is like thinking they're good swimmers because they got wet walking through a rainstorm. The Yale team somewhat gently described this problem as mistaking outsourced knowledge for internal knowledge. A blunter way of putting it would be to say that people can't remember most of what they see while blowing through dozens of mouse clicks. As the writer Tom Jacobs observed, searching appears to trigger an utterly unjustified belief in one's own knowledge, which, given the increasingly popular habit of instinctively looking online to answer virtually any question, is a bit terrifying. It may well be terrifying, but it's definitely annoying. These mistaken assertions of gained knowledge can make the job of an expert nearly impossible. There is no way to enlighten people who believe they've gained a decade's worth of knowledge because they've spent a morning with a search engine. Few words in a discussion with a layperson can make an expert's heart sink, like hearing, "I've done some research." How can exposure to so much information fail to produce at least some kind of increased baseline of knowledge, if only by electronic osmosis? How can people read so much yet retain so little? The answer is simple. Few people are actually reading what they find. As a University College of London, UCL, study found, people don't actually read the articles they encounter during a search on the internet. Instead, they glance at the top line or the first few sentences and then move on. Internet users, the researchers noted, are not reading online in the traditional sense. Indeed, there are signs that new forms of reading are emerging as users power browse horizontally through titles, contents pages, and abstracts going for quick wins. It almost seems that they go online to avoid reading in the traditional sense. This is actually the opposite of reading, aimed not so much at learning, but at winning arguments or confirming a pre-existing belief. Children and younger people are especially vulnerable to this tendency. The UCL study suggested that this is because they have unsophisticated mental maps of what the internet is, often failing to appreciate that it is a collection of networked resources from different providers, and so they spend little time actually evaluating information either for relevance, accuracy, or authority. These youngsters do not find library-sponsored resources intuitive and therefore prefer to use Google or Yahoo instead, because these services offer a familiar, if simplistic, solution for their study needs. Teachers and other experts are not immune from the same temptations. Power browsing and viewing, according to the study, appear to be the norm for all. The popularity of abstracts among older researchers rather gives the game away. Society, the UCL study's authors conclude, is dumbing down. This already serious problem might even be a bit scarier than it looks. Internet users tend to gravitate toward, and to believe, whichever results of a search come up first in the rankings, mostly without regard to the origins of those results. After all, if the search engine trusted it enough to rank it highly, it must be worthwhile. This is why anyone pushing content on the internet looks at ways to improve where their product shows up in a search. If you sell soup, you'll do what you can to rattle a search engine so that people looking for soup recipes are steered instead toward coupons for your brand of soup. But what if you're selling something more important than soup, like a political candidate? There is at least some evidence that search engine rankings can alter people's perceptions of political reality. In 2014, two psychologists completed a study of what they called the search engine manipulation effect, and claimed that their tests showed an ability to boost the proportion of people who favored any candidate by between 37 and 63% after just one search session, and that this potentially constitutes a serious threat to the democratic system of government. It's too early to say that search engines are undermining democracy, at least yet. But it's hard to argue with the reality that most laypeople can no longer tell the difference between real information and whatever a search engine burps up. The wisdom of megacrowds. Obviously, non-experts are not always wrong about everything, nor are experts always right. Once in a blue moon, a teenager can get it right, and a team of doctors can get it wrong. Experts are important, but ordinary people do manage to live their lives every day without the advice of professors, intellectuals, and other know-it-alls. The internet, used properly, can help lay people reach out to each other for basic information that might be too costly or difficult to access from professionals. In fact, the internet, like the stock market and other mechanisms that aggregate the public's guesses and hunches about complicated matters, can produce moments where laypeople outperform experts. The way in which a lot of wrong guesses can be milled into one big right guess is a well-established phenomenon. Unfortunately, the way people think the internet can serve as a way of crowdsourcing knowledge conflates the perfectly reasonable idea of what the writer James Surowiecki has called the wisdom of crowds with the completely unreasonable idea that the crowds are wise because each member of the mob is also wise. Sometimes people without any specialized knowledge can make a better guess at something in a large group than any one member of the group. This tends to be true especially for decisions where the amalgamation of a lot of guesses might produce a better aggregate guess than any one expert's opinion. Surowiecki recounted the story, for example, of an English county fair in 1906, when the public was asked to guess the weight of an ox. The average of the guesses was better than any one person's guess and ended up almost exactly on the mark. Likewise, the world's stock exchanges, collectively, are generally better than any one stock analyst at betting on stocks. There are a lot of reasons crowds are better at estimation than individuals, including the way in which a large number of guesses among a lot of people can help to wash out a certain amount of confirmation bias, misperception, or any other number of errors. It also allows people with only partial information to bring those small amounts of knowledge to a problem and help solve it, much in the way 1,000 people can complete a huge jigsaw puzzle, even though each of them may only have a few pieces. To take one example, the unbiased eye of the crowd actually cost one of the most prominent journalists in America his job. In 2004, at the height of a U.S. presidential election, longtime CBS News anchor Dan Rather and his producers went on the air with a story about incumbent President George W. Bush's military record. CBS claimed to have documents from the early 1970s proving that Bush ditched his Air National Guard unit and never finished his required service. Bush, a commander-in-chief who at that point had led America into two major wars, was running against Senator John Kerry, a decorated war hero, and the charge was, naturally, electrifying in a race that focused heavily on military issues. Bush supporters objected to what they claimed was dodgy sourcing and sloppy reporting, but in the end, ordinary people on the internet, not angry partisans, brought the story down. Lay people with no experience in journalism, but who spent plenty of time around computers, noticed that the font in the documents closely matched those generated by Microsoft's Word software. Obviously, in 1971, the Air Force used typewriters. Microsoft and its programs didn't exist then. The documents had to be fakes. Faced with this crowdsourced challenge to the story, CBS ordered an investigation. The network ended up repudiating the documents and the story. The segment's producer was fired. Dan Rather, convinced to this day that he was right and everyone else was wrong, retired and sued his old employer. He lost. So, who needs experts? If we ask the same question enough times or set enough people to work on the same subject, why not rely on their collective wisdom instead of seeking the flawed or biased opinion of only a handful of self-anointed wise ones? If one person is smart and 100 smarter, then a billion communicating instantly must be even smarter still. Enthusiasts of the online reference site, Wikipedia, among others, have argued that the future rests with this kind of collective knowledge rather than with the expert vetting of references and information. In theory, with a public and open encyclopedia to which anyone can contribute, the sheer number of people watching over each entry should root out error and bias. The articles would be geared toward the inquisitive minds of ordinary human beings rather than the narrow interests of a panel of scholars or editors. Not only would the entries be in a constant and evolving state of accuracy, but the articles themselves, by definition, would constitute a collection about things that actually engage the readers instead of a systematic but useless compendium of esoteric knowledge. Unfortunately, things have not always worked out that way, and Wikipedia is a good lesson in the limits of the internet-driven displacement of expertise. As it turns out, writing articles about any number of complicated subjects is a lot more difficult than guessing the weight of a bull. Although many well-intentioned people have contributed their time as Wikipedia editors, for example, some of them were also employed by companies and celebrity public relations firms that had an obvious interest in how things appeared in an encyclopedia for the masses. 9 out of 10 Wikipedia contributors are also male, which would likely raise flags among readers if readers knew it. Even with the best of intentions, crowdsourced projects like Wikipedia suffer from an important but often unremarked distinction between laypeople and professionals. Volunteers do what interests them at any given time, while professionals employ their expertise every day. A hobby is not the same thing as a career. As a saying attributed to the British writer Alistair Cook goes, professionals are people who can do their best work when they don't feel like it. The enthusiasm of interested amateurs is not a consistent substitute for the judgment of experts. Wikipedia's initial efforts fell prey to inconsistency and a lack of oversight, which is exactly what might have been expected from a group homework project. A researcher who studied these trends suggested that Wikipedia, after 2007, should have changed its motto from "the encyclopedia that anyone can edit" to "the encyclopedia that anyone who understands the norms, socializes him or herself, dodges the impersonal wall of semi-automated rejection, and still wants to voluntarily contribute his or her time and energy can edit." Eventually, Wikipedia imposed stricter editing controls. But those restrictions in turn discouraged new contributors. As a 2013 article in the MIT Technology Review noted, the size of the volunteer force that built Wikipedia and must defend it against vandalism, hoaxes, and manipulation has shrunk by more than a third since 2007 and is still shrinking. Wikipedia still struggles to maintain the quality of its own articles, even measured by its own criteria. The article went on to say, among the significant problems that aren't getting resolved is the site's skewered coverage. Its entries on Pokemon and female porn stars are comprehensive, but its pages on female novelists or places in sub-Saharan Africa are sketchy. Authoritative entries remain elusive. Of the 1,000 articles that the project's own volunteers have tagged as forming the core of a good encyclopedia, most don't earn even Wikipedia's own middle-ranking quality scores. Wikipedia does have featured articles, which must be well-written, comprehensive, and well-researched, including a thorough and representative survey of the relevant literature, with claims verified against high-quality, reliable sources. In other words, what Wikipedia really wants is for its best pieces to be just like peer-reviewed scholarship, only without using actual peers. Peer review is a difficult beast to manage even in optimal conditions, with editors trying to assign oversight to the best in each field while avoiding professional rivalries and other conflicts of interest. Translating this process into a project for millions of people with minimal supervision was an unreasonable goal. For something like Wikipedia to work, practically every subject matter expert in the world would have to be willing to babysit every entry. Of course, if measured by readership, Wikipedia works just fine. And on some subjects, Wikipedia is a perfectly serviceable source of information. As the MIT article noted, articles are skewed toward technical, Western, and male-dominated subject matter. So when it comes to tangible, and more important, uncontroversial information, Wikipedia has succeeded in bringing together a lot of data in a reliable and stable format. Personally, I love that Wikipedia is a great source for the plot of almost any movie, no matter how small or obscure. If you want to know who discovered strontium, who attended the Washington Naval Conference of 1925, or a quick explanation of last year's Nobel Prizes, Wikipedia is a lot better than a random search engine. Once any kind of political agenda gets involved, things get a lot dicier. The Wikipedia entry on the chemical weapon sarin, for example, became an arena for infighting among people who had conflicting agendas over whether the Syrian government used the substance on its own people. Even the basic science fell under attack. A London-based analyst, Dan Cazetta, the sarin expert I mentioned in the last chapter who learned a hard lesson about trying to help a college student, told me in late 2015 that if someone were to rely on the current Wikipedia page for accurate information about the chemical warfare agent sarin, they would be misled by half-truths and numerous vague statements not supported by the supplied references. Some of the information on the wiki page, while technically correct in some aspects, is worded in ways that are misleading. Some of the statements are false. Cazetta added that he spent many hours after the 2013 use of sarin in Syria correcting misconceptions about sarin, many of which were doubtless attributable to errors and half-truths on relevant Wikipedia pages. What people misunderstand about Wikipedia and other online resources, and about the wisdom of crowds in general, is that knowledge is about a lot more than assembling a box of factoids or making coin toss predictions. Facts don't speak for themselves. Sources like Wikipedia are valuable for basic data as a kind of perpetually updating almanac, but they're not much help on more complex matters. Crowds can be wise. Not everything, however, is amenable to the vote of a crowd. The internet creates a false sense that the opinions of many people are tantamount to a fact. How a virus is transmitted from one human being to another is not the same thing as guessing how many jelly beans are in a glass barrel. As the comedian John Oliver has complained, you don't need to gather opinions on a fact. You might as well have a poll asking, which number is bigger, 15 or 5? Do owls exist? Or are there hats? Likewise, public policy is not a parlor game of prediction. It's about long-term choices rooted in thoughtful consideration of costs and alternatives. Asking crowds to guess about specific events in short-term, mental dart-throwing matches just isn't much help when trying to navigate in difficult policy waters. Will Bashir Assad of Syria use chemical weapons at some point in 2013 is an even bet, like putting a chip on one color in roulette. It's a yes or no question, and at some point you've either won or lost the bet. It's not the same question as, why would Bashar Assad use chemical weapons? And it is light years away from the dilemma of, what should America do if Bashar Assad uses chemical weapons? The internet, however, conflates all three of these questions and turns every complicated issue into a poll with a one-click radio button offering a quick solution. The ease with which people can weigh in on these issues and even sometimes get a prediction about them right when experts might have been wrong bolts another layer of anti-intellectual armor to the resistance among laypeople to views more informed than their own. I unfriend you. Learning new things requires patience and the ability to listen to other people. The internet and social media, however, are making us less social and more confrontational. Online, as in life, people are clustering into small echo chambers, preferring only to talk to those with whom they already agree. The writer Bill Bishop called this the Big Sort in a 2008 book, noting that Americans now choose to live, work, and socialize more with people like themselves in every way. The same thing happens on the internet. We're not just associating with people more like ourselves, we're actively breaking ties with everyone else, especially on social media. A 2014 Pew Research study found that liberals are more likely than conservatives to block or unfriend people with whom they disagreed, but mostly because conservatives already tend to have fewer people with whom they disagreed in their online social circles in the first place. Or, as a Washington Post review of the study put it, conservatives have lower levels of ideological diversity in their online ecosystem. Liberals were also somewhat more likely to end a friendship over politics in real life, but the overall trend is one of ideological segregation, enabled by the ability to end a friendship with a click instead of a face-to-face discussion. This unwillingness to hear out others not only makes us all more unpleasant with each other in general, but also makes us less able to think, to argue persuasively, and to accept correction when we're wrong. When we are incapable of sustaining a chain of reasoning past a few mouse clicks, we cannot tolerate even the smallest challenge to our beliefs or ideas. This is dangerous because it both undermines the role of knowledge and expertise in a modern society and corrodes the basic ability of people to get along with each other in a democracy. Underlying much of this ill temper is a false sense of equality and the illusion of egalitarianism created by the immediacy of social media. I have a Twitter account and a Facebook page, and so do you. So, we're peers, aren't we? After all, if a top reporter at a major newspaper, a diplomat at the Kennedy School, a scientist at a research hospital, and your Aunt Rose from Reno all have an online presence, then all of our views are just so many messages speeding past your eyes. Every opinion is only as good as the last posting on a homepage. In the age of social media, people using the internet assume that everyone is equally intelligent or informed merely by virtue of being online. As the New York Times movie critic A.O. Scott has put it, on the internet, everyone is a critic, a Yelp-fueled takedown artist, an Amazon scholar, a cheerleader empowered by social media to like and to share. The inflated, always suspect authority of ink-stained wretches like me has been leveled by digital anarchy. Who needs a cranky nag when you have a friendly algorithm telling you, based on your previous purchases, that there is something you may also like, and legions of Facebook friends affirming the wisdom of your choice? The anonymity of social media tempts users into arguing as though every participant is the same, a group of peers starting from the same level of background and education. This is a rule very few people would use in real life, but on the internet, the intellectual narcissism of the random commenter displaces the norms that usually govern face-to-face interactions. This strange combination of distance and intimacy poisons conversation. Reasonable arguments require participants to be honest and well-intentioned. Actual proximity builds trust and understanding. We are not just brains in a tank processing disparate pieces of data. We hear out another person in part by relying on multiple visual and auditory cues, not just by watching their words stream past our eyes. Teachers, especially, know that the same material delivered at a distance or on a screen has a different impact than personal interaction with a student who can ask questions, furrow a brow, or show an expression of sudden understanding. Distance and anonymity remove patience and presumptions of goodwill. Rapid access to information and the ability to speak without having to listen, combined with the keyboard courage that allows people to say things to each other electronically they would never say in person, kill conversation. As the writer Andrew Sullivan has noted, this is in part because nothing on the internet is dispositive, and so every participant in a debate demands to be taken as seriously as every other. Sullivan goes on to write, "And what mainly fuels this is precisely what the founders feared about democratic culture: feeling, emotion, and narcissism, rather than reason, empiricism, and public-spiritedness. Online debates become personal, emotional, and irresolvable almost as soon as they begin. Yes, occasional rational points still fly back and forth, but there are dramatically fewer elite arbiters to establish which of those points is actually true or valid or relevant." Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, and other online sites can be outlets for intelligent discussion. But too often these and other venues become nothing more than a fusillade of assertions, certainties, poor information, and insults, rather than actual exchanges. To be sure, the internet is also facilitating conversations among people who might never otherwise have encountered each other. Introverts might argue that an arena like Reddit or the comments section of an online journal opens the door for more interaction from people who, in an earlier time, might have been reluctant to engage in a public discussion. Unfortunately, allowing anyone to express a view means that almost everyone will express a view, which is why so many publications, from the Toronto Sun to the Daily Beast, have been shutting down their online comments sections. All of this interaction is doing little to loosen the attachment of laypeople to misinformation. In fact, the problem may be worse than we think. When confronted by hard evidence that they're wrong, some people will simply double down on their original assertion rather than accept their error. This is the backfire effect, in which people redouble their efforts to keep their own internal narrative consistent, no matter how clear the indications that they're wrong. The internet, as David Dunning points out, sharpens this problem in multiple ways, not least that refuting a dumb idea requires repeating it at least once in the course of the discussion. This creates a minefield for teachers and other experts who risk confirming a mistake merely by acknowledging its existence. He writes, "Then, of course, there is the problem of rampant misinformation in places that, unlike classrooms, are hard to control, like the internet and news media. In these Wild West settings, it's best not to repeat common misbeliefs at all. Telling people that Barack Obama is not a Muslim fails to change many people's minds because they frequently remember everything that was said except for the crucial qualifier, not." Experts trying to confront this kind of stubborn ignorance may think they're helping, when in fact they're basically trying to throw water on a grease fire. It doesn't work, and only spreads the damage around. The internet is the largest anonymous medium in human history. The ability to argue from a distance and the cheapening sense of equality it provides is corroding trust and respect among all of us, experts and laypeople alike. Alone in front of the keyboard, but awash in websites, newsletters, and online groups dedicated to confirming any and every idea, the internet has politically and intellectually mired millions of Americans in their own biases. Social media outlets such as Facebook amplify this echo chamber. As Megan McArdle wrote in 2016, Even if we are not deliberately blocking people who disagree with us, Facebook curates our feeds so that we get more of the stuff we like. What do we like? People and posts that agree with us. This is especially dangerous now that social media, like Facebook and Twitter, have become the primary sources of news and information for many Americans. And experts trying to break through this shell of political insularity and self-assured ignorance do so at their peril. It's difficult enough to argue with one person who has gotten something wrong. It's quite another to try to reason with someone as they gather pretty websites as evidence and marshal legions of anonymous, like-minded social media friends with equally uninformed views for support. Meanwhile, scholars and professionals who insist on logic, foundational knowledge, and basic rules about sources risk condemnation by 21st century online users as nothing more than elitists who don't understand the miracles of the information age. Websites and internet polls might be unreliable, but reporters can dig out the truth instead of getting pulled down into the whirlpool. Journalists can still serve as the arbiters of all this chaos using the careful tools of investigation, sourcing, and fact-checking. Or, as we'll discover in the next chapter, perhaps not.